Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
A few of you know, but not most of you, I have been the head teacher of Zen Heart Sangha, which is a sister sangha to this one, for almost 35 years. At some point during my role as priest and development and all of that, Les suggested that I start a sitting group. There had been a couple of the little sitting groups. There was one in Montero with my friends Diane and Flip. And I think that's what he thought it was going to be. It was just a little sitting group that, you know, two or three people. And it grew and it grew. And finally it had a group that's about as big as this one here at Canando. And so at some point we incorporated and became a nonprofit. And I remember sitting around my round dining room table when we were thinking, well, what should we call ourselves? I said, well, Zen has to be in the title. And I said, what else? We're not a temple exactly. We don't have a building. So we agreed that Sangha needed to be one of the words. And then I said, all right, well, we need like a third word, and immediately everyone said, heart, Zen Heart Sangha. And that is how that came to be. However, this coming Saturday, I am having what's called a stepping down ceremony. And Les had one a couple years ago to step down as his role of abbot here at Canando. I have never been an abbot, but as head teacher, I've pretty much had all that responsibility. So on Saturday, a lot of people, it turns out, are coming. Other teachers that I have worked with over these 40 years, all of my Sangha, many other students who I've been friends with, Dharma brothers and sisters. And so it's, as somebody said yesterday, it's a little bittersweet. I'm in the middle of sitting sesshin at Jikoji Zen Center up on the hill on Skyline Boulevard, where I am also a teacher. And a woman that I've only met a few times was there, and she was wondering if I was coming for the whole sesshin. And I said, well, no, actually, I've got a few things to do this week, because this is a really big ceremony, and there's a lot of things to do. And I explained to her, and she said, oh, that sounds just so wonderful, but a little bittersweet. I said, yes, exactly. I have loved being the teacher of this Sangha. I have made lifelong friends, deepened my own practice because of their practice. So recently, next Monday I'll give another talk, but by that time I will not be their head teacher anymore. I will be teacher emeritus, whatever that means. But last Monday was the last time I was going to be giving a talk with my group as their teacher, their head teacher. And so in the same way that I always think, you know, what is it I want to say to all of you and hear from all of you, I thought a lot about what I wanted to say to them. And mostly what I came up with was what I always talk about, which is death and dying and impermanence and all those fun things, which are the reality of our life. And the fleeting nature of life, how fast it all goes by. At the time I was being ordained in 1988 as a priest, I had a dream. And the dream was of me wearing a brown robe, which is only for teachers, and having very short gray hair I had long blonde hair at the moment before I was ordained. And so this was a very odd dream. And I thought, maybe a little arrogant of me to even think such a possibility. And yet, here I am. Much the same way, when I was a little girl, I lived in Michigan in my first 7 years. And I went to a Catholic school for first grade. I had a wonderful nun. I know that my brothers, my older brother and older sister did not have such a great experience, but I did, because Sister Joan Christine loved children. Anyway, because of that experience with Sister Joan Christine, I decided I wanted two things. I wanted to be a nun, and I wanted to be a teacher. So all along the way, my parents kept saying, "You can't be a nun. You like boys too much," which was probably true. But then when I got to be in high school and was getting ready to go off to college, they basically said, "You shouldn't be a teacher either." And it's like, because at that time in California, believe it or not, there was a teacher glut. My father decided I should go into drama acting. I was like, "You think I'm going to get a job that way?" So instead, I did what any normal crazy person would do. I double majored in art and biology, neither of which was having much to do with an occupation. It was simply by an accident of fate that I ended up at Peninsula School in Menlo Park. I had earned my way through college in all the libraries. And so while I didn't have a library of science degree, I knew a lot about how libraries worked. And they needed someone in their library. And so I self-educated to become, I think, a pretty good children's librarian over 33 years. All of this to say that it has, again, passed like that. I still remember sitting at the old Kanando. I remember who gave me my Zazen instruction. How many of you remember the first person to give you Zazen instruction? Yeah, that's an important person. So life is fleeting. It goes by very fast. 1 minute you're young, and the next minute you have gray hair, eye trouble, ear trouble, things wear out. But with practice, all I can say is I am filled with gratitude for every moment. Every moment in my life now is so precious. No time to lose, no time to waste. Just like the Han says, don't waste time, because you haven't got much of it. So right now, things might seem a little crazy in the world. And you might be thinking, what am I supposed to do with that? How am I supposed to not feel overwhelmed, confused, betrayed, hopeless, helpless? So, in the Book of Serenity, which is a series of Zen koans, these teaching stories, case 12 is called Dai Zhang Planting the Fields. When you go back to all of these old stories, what you find out is that in some ways, their lives were not so different than ours. The Buddha understood this. You know, there will be suffering. First rule, right? First law of the Buddha. There will be suffering, there will be dissatisfaction, and you have a body, and that's why. So in this story, first, Dai Zhang meets this monk who's been traveling, whose name is Zuishan. And he says, where do you come from? And Zuishan says, from the south. Now remember, this takes place in China. So the South could be South China. It could also be the Theravadan countries of Burma, Vietnam, Cambodia. So he's been traveling a lot for a while. So then Daizhang says, so how is Buddhism in the South these days? Zuishan answers, and I imagine a little smugly, there's extensive discussion. Daizhang answers, well, how can that compare to me here, planting the fields and making rice to eat? And Zuishan says, well, what can you do about the world? And Daizhang answers, what do you call the world? This is a great story. As I was reading it recently, I thought, oh my goodness, Daizhang must have been just rolling his eyes in his head at this. You know, he says he wants to know, how's Buddhism doing in the South? This is a reasonable question to ask. He's a Buddhist priest, this guy's a Buddhist monk. And Zuishan says, oh, there's extensive discussion. I'm sure that from Daizhang's point of view, it's like, what has that got to do with the price of rice? Talk, 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 talk. So Daizhang kindly, instead of saying, what are you talking about? Instead, he's very nice. He says, well, you know, how can that compare to me here, planting the fields and making rice to eat? In other words, what is the point of philosophizing of all these words about the way instead of just doing it? One of the sutras that we chant, the Xin Qin Ming, at the very end it says, words, the way is beyond language. For in it, there is no yesterday, no tomorrow, and no today. In other words, there's just this moment right here, right now. There's nothing else. The way is beyond language, even extensive discussion. Because once we try to describe what we're doing here in words, we find we can't do it. How many of you have had the experience of trying to talk to someone who is not doing this practice about what it is you do here? Yeah, me too. In the beginning, it was trying to talk to my family, who eventually got it, and then close friends. But you also have to be very clear in yourself what you're doing here before trying to describe it to somebody else, because it is very hard to describe. And people are always saying, oh, well, so what do you get out of this meditation practice? It's like, I don't get anything. I lose something, but I don't get anything. And that perplexes them even more. Why would you do something where you lose, right? When we try to describe this experience, all we're actually able to do is what they say about the finger pointing at the moon. The moon is it, and I'm just sort of pointing at it, hoping that you have your own experience, because even if I were Shakespeare and could say it beautifully, my experience is not exactly the same as yours. And in fact, there are many Zen teachers who say, you know, don't talk so much, because it just encourages people to think you know what you're talking about and to try and have your experience instead of their own. So this is why we do meditation, to allow our small self, our ego self, to settle down long enough, to shut up long enough, that our actual original mind has some place to arise. It's like the story of the teacher talking to his student, and he's pouring tea into the student's teacup as the student goes on and on and on about something, until finally he says, "Oh, master, the teacup is overflowing." And the teacher says, "Yes, it's very hard to fill a full teacup." In other words, if you're so full of all your own ideas, there's no space for anything else to arise. So you can imagine, though, when Daizhang says this about, well, how can that compare to me here planting the fields and, you know, for rice to eat, he gets a little defensive. Like, well. And so he says, well, what can you do about the world? How many times have you heard that recently? You're talking about what's going on out there, the craziness of it, the cruelty of it, the nonsense of it. And then finally someone throws up their hands, well, what can you do? That's this. They were doing this 1,000 years ago. We're still doing it today, going, well, what can you do about the world? The world is the world. But Daizhang, first of all, he's probably wondering, who is this dolt standing in front of me? But rather than just walking away, he gives him one final chance, what's called a turning word. And he says, what do you call the world? What is this world that we think that we can't do anything about? Huh? What do you call the world? There is the world that we're very familiar with, the one of samsara, where we live most of the time, and many people only live there. This is the world of greed, you know, thirsting desire. I want what I want when I want it. Hatred or aversion, oh, I don't want that. Or delusion or ignorance. Ignorance of what? Delusion of the belief that we are all separate, completely permanent, abiding individuals. The good thing is that when you sit down and you try to put your finger on yourself and think, oh, who is this one here? You find it's very hard to do because anything you think about yourself or say about yourself is fleeting, and in the next moment it's something else. And so what you realize is actually there is no permanent abiding nature of you or me or Zoom or the oil lamps or anything else. Even things that we think are really permanent, like this building, for instance. Not to hex anything, but if we had a huge earthquake, this building might come down. Mountains move. Rivers change course. Things that seem permanent are not. Nothing is, except for the fact of impermanence. So, most of the time we're living in that world, the world of greed and hatred and delusion. And we think that is the world. In Buddhism, though, we call that the relative world. We need to be in that world because when we leave here tonight, we're going to be on the street, and we need to know that when it turns yellow, we need to slow down and stop. Because if we continue on through, somebody might hit us or we might hit them. So there's nothing wrong with the relative world as long as you understand it's not the only thing. there is also the world of the big mind, of our original nature. Sometimes it's called the ground of being. Sometimes the great cloud of unknowing. Some people call it God or Buddha nature. I don't actually care what you call it. When you sit down on your cushion, you have an experience of it because it contains everything. This is called the absolute realm, and the absolute realm contains the relative world. So Dai Zhang's question, what do you call the world, goes straight to the heart, straight to the point. When he says that, when Zuishan says, well, what can you do about the world? He's talking about the relative world. And it's true, the relative world seems pretty crazy right now. Greed, hate, delusion, prejudice, racism, anti-Semitism, cruelty. They're all out there. And it may feel hopeless to try to do anything as a single individual. But when he asks, what do you call the world? He is pointing to the enlightenment of the ancestors. He's pointing to Shakyamuni Buddha. It may seem to you right now that the world is particularly chaotic, uncertain, impermanent. But truly, if you are also a student of history, you know this is nothing new. I'm pretty sure that when Rome was burning and Caligula and Nero were in charge, it felt pretty chaotic. Equally so in Nazi Germany. I'm pretty sure that a lot of people thought it was the end of the world, because for some 6 million people it was. This is all exactly what the Buddha was talking about 2,500 years ago. The causes of suffering and the cessation of suffering. He didn't leave us with, oh, well, you know, greed, hate, and delusion, what are you going to do about it? You know, no. He understood something very important. He saw that there could be a cessation to suffering. Remember, in his youth, he's been very protected because there was a prophecy. And the prophecy said that your son is either going to be the greatest king of all time. Remember, this is 2,500 years ago in India. There probably haven't been that many kingdoms. But, or he is going to be the greatest sage, teacher of all time. His father is the current king. What do you think he wants? Like all fathers, he wants a successor. So this child has been treated with kid gloves. He has been educated. He has been loved. He's been taken care of in such a kind, gentle way, much the way I imagine that the Dalai Lama was taken care of from the moment they recognized him and brought him back to the Potala Palace. Everyone who was ever with him treated him with kindness and love. How do you grow up in an environment like that? You grow up to be a lovely person. Most of us did not have that advantage, but the Buddha did. So he's very sheltered. And at some point, it's late teens, he becomes a little curious. Well, you know, what goes on out there outside of the palace? So he calls his charioteer to him. He says, you know, I want to go into town. charioteer's probably been told not to do this, but, you know, this is his master, so he's got to obey. So off they go into town. And the first thing he sees is this really sickly-looking person lying on a pallet, you know, all white-faced and drooling and, you know, pus and all that. And he's like, whoa, what is that? That is illness, master. Whoa. And they go a little further, and now he sees an ancient, decrepit old man. He's been surrounded by young people. Even his parents aren't that old. And he, well, what is that? Oh, well, that's old age, sire. And then a funeral cortege goes by with a dead body and people holding the bier and lots of mourning and weeping and this and that. And what is that? And that is death, sire. All of this has been probably hidden from him. It's not that people didn't get sick at the palace. It's not that they didn't die. It's that it was all put to one side so that he was not a part of it, so that Siddhartha Shakyamuni led this, you know, graced life. And now all of a sudden, this is all being presented. And being an intelligent, thoughtful, kind person, he's deeply affected by it. He sees that suffering is caused by two separate things. The first one has to do with having a body. You are going to get sick. If you are lucky, you are going to get old. I have known too many people who died very young. Students at my school, a 12-year-old, 14-year-old. So if you're lucky, you actually get to be old. And then you are going to die. It's just a fact. You know, they accuse Zen people of being rather morbid because we're always talking about death and dying. All we're doing is stating the obvious and the inevitable. We are going to die. These three things are not something that you can change. Not if you have a body. You're going to get sick because there's illness out there. You, as I say, if you're lucky, you're going to get old. And hopefully you're going to enjoy every minute of it. And then someday, you're going to get very feeble, if you're lucky. And you're going to die a long, slow death. Or you're going to die by misadventure, car crash, falling off a rock, something. So he realized those are things you can't change. But the second category, big difference. His great understanding was the suffering engendered by the three poisons of greed, hatred, and delusion. And the delusion of separation, of alone, that I'm doing this all by myself, is the hardest of all. Not getting what you want or getting what you don't want, but being alone turns out to be really hard for human beings. We are pack animals. But he realizes that is something we can do something about. That's when he goes on his long journey and he ends up under the, you know, the Bodhi tree. And he's been traveling with his friends, and of course his five friends have all gotten to this conclusion that they have to kill the body in order to free the mind. This was sort of a current philosophy at the time with many of the teachers and the sages and the gurus. And so there are actually statues of the Buddha lying on his side where he looks like one of those people who are dying from starvation. You see every rib, every bone in the body because there's no skin left because they're dying. And he's under the Bodhi tree. And he knows he's dying. He can't concentrate. And along comes this young girl, Sujata. She's a goat herder, and she barters her milk, the goat milk, and she sees this unfortunate young man who's clearly in bad shape. And she offers him a bowl of her goat milk, and at first he's ready to refuse. But in that moment, he has his first big opening, his first big understanding of, if I don't take some nourishment now, I will be dead by tomorrow. And so even though he promised his other friends, who have gone off in different directions, that none of them are going to eat until they have the great enlightenment, he realizes he's going to die without having had it. And so he accepts that bowl of milk, and the rest, as they say, is history. Because then he continues to have more milk, brings himself back to life, sits under the Bodhi tree for 3 days and nights, and then he has his really big enlightenment. And what was that? That was the one that made him realize that you can't do anything about the body, but you can certainly do something about the mind. So this is the world. How are we going to meet it without falling apart? This is the world of birth and death, joy, sorrow, friends, enemies. It is the complete package. Blood, sweat, tears, good, bad, the whole deal. So first of all, as we are meeting it, please, it is not about resignation. It is not, oh, well, what can you do about the world? Oh, you can do plenty. There's apparently a new book out by Judith Viorst, who writes funny books, especially as she's getting older, and it's called Making the Best of What's Left. When we're too old to get the chairs reupholstered. I'm sure it's a very funny book because she's a clever writer, but I saw the title and I thought, making the best of what's left? Ack! No, I want to make the best of every moment. Not what's left. That sounds like resignation to me. When we did the before lecture verse, an unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect dharma is rarely met with, even in 100,000 million kalpas, which is a very long time. It doesn't mean that there's no dharma in all that time. What it means is mostly we're not meeting it. Mostly we're just sort of la 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 through our life, getting up, making breakfast, taking a shower, la da 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 da. It says an unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect dharma is rarely met with. Not because it's not in front of us. In every moment, each one of you is a dharma. Each one of you is a dharma. The flame is a dharma. The floor is a dharma. This temple is a dharma. Everyone you meet and everything you do is a dharma. We have this wonderful opportunity to completely meet each moment, but most of the time we're not. Most of the time, we distract ourselves. And I'm as guilty as anybody. I love watching movies. I love reading books. But if you're distracting yourself from something that needs your attention, that's a problem. That is not meeting the Dharma. So our tendency, when things are painful or difficult is to turn away, to deny, to pretend, distract from painful things. And I've used this metaphor before. It's the best one I can think of, though. It's as if a professional pitcher is 90 feet away from you, and they throw a ball, a baseball, at 100 miles an hour at you. Oh, a baseball is coming. I don't like baseballs. I'm going to turn away. The baseball's still going to hit you, only now it's really going to hurt because you knew it was coming and you still turned away. When we face it, though, we have lots of options. We can duck. We can catch it. Use a mitt, though. It's coming very fast. The fact is, when we actually meet each moment, good or bad or indifferent, then we are in this place, this settled place of the Dharma. How are we going to meet each moment right now? Without all of these feelings that many of us are having, being overwhelmed, crushed, deserted, alone. So recently, my Dharma sister at Jikoji said something so wonderful. She said, the world is burning up. What we need are lots of people with buckets of water. You don't need to throw yourself on the fire. I love this for many reasons. First of all, she doesn't say what size bucket of water you need to be. So you could be this kind of bucket of water, something very small, like smiling at the grocery clerk. You're throwing water, purifying the space, purifying the person in front of you by smiling, by being welcoming. You could have a bigger one, which you see someone who needs your help and you stop and you help them. Or you could do a really big bucket that has to do with going out and volunteering someplace, you know, ecumenical hunger program in Mountain View, something like that. It doesn't really matter. The size of your bucket doesn't matter. And it depends on your own personal capabilities and circumstances. Sometimes we're able to have a really big bucket of water to put that fire out. Sometimes all we have is just a little bit. It's okay. Whatever you have, whatever you can do, makes a difference. That part you have to take on faith, but I have seen it myself. But I also love the part of you don't need to throw yourself on the fire. Because I think that sometimes we think that in order to make a difference, we have to just burn ourselves out. We have to give so much that there's then nothing left. That is not a good idea either. You need to take care of yourselves so that you can take care of others. We each do exactly what we can in the moment that's in front of us. That is how we meet the Dharma. Sometimes it's as small as putting a name card on the altar and offering bows and incense for that person. Sometimes it's taking food to a friend or driving someone someplace because they can't drive. Sometimes it's even bigger. Yeah. Sometimes you have to take on a big responsibility to take care of someone who's dying. This is going to happen. The more people you know, the more people are going to be dying in your life. And you're going to find yourself being called upon because you are the people who can actually do this. Those of us who practice, we know how to be there with the dying. We don't have to talk. We can just sit with someone. And not everybody, believe me, from my own experience, not everyone knows how to do that. But you do, because you practice it here all the time. So it's been very interesting for me, knowing that I am stepping down as the head teacher of my Sangha, knowing that I am going to be moving physically away, not too far, but so I won't be here as often. You know, selling my home of 40 years and my beautiful garden. These are all huge transitions for me. And I am so grateful for practice to keep reminding me, let go. Just let go. There's only one thing that matters in the world. And that is this. Our one-to-one with each other. Our relationships with people. Our relationships with our animals. Our relationships with our world. So we need to learn how to meet the world from a place of abundance rather than scarcity. Rather than worrying about what you do not have, thinking about what you do. I have a beautiful home and I need to give it up because I have glaucoma. I can't do anything about the glaucoma that I haven't already done. It's okay. I'm learning how to live with it. But it does mean I have to make some pretty big changes because I live up on Skyline Boulevard and after a big winding road, and pretty soon that's not going to be such a good idea for me to be driving. These are the things that happen as we get older. We think it's all going to last forever, and then here we are. I go to visit Les and Mary once a week. I don't think that they were quite ready. It all got speeded up because of the fire in their home. I don't think we're ever quite ready. But it's a good idea to think about it. What are we going to do to meet our own life? How are we going to appreciate what we have completely and not worry about what we don't have? Because there are many people in the world who have so much less than we have. Pay attention to what is actually here right now. Appreciate it. Express gratitude for every single second. The entire universe is expressed in each and everything. Each thing is, in fact, the entire universe. And this is really what we call the world. So I'm going to end with a poem that my friend Nenzen shared with me. We did a memorial a week and a half ago for a young man who was a staff member of Alice's restaurant up near where I live. He was also an avid motorcyclist, and unfortunately, a bit reckless. This is according to other people who knew him, not me. And he crashed and he died. And this was 2 weeks ago, and he was only 21. So Nenzen and I did a sort of ecumenical memorial at Alice's for all the staff, just to honor his memory. Because when I first heard, all I could think of was, his poor mother. You know, there is, in my experience, nothing worse for a parent than to lose a child. So this was the poem that Nenzen read that day. It's by Mary Oliver, of course, and it's called In Blackwater Woods. Look, the trees are turning their own bodies into pillars of light, are giving off the rich fragrance of cinnamon and fulfillment. The long tapers of cattails are bursting and floating away over the blue shoulders of the ponds. And every pond, no matter what its name is nameless now. Every year, everything I have ever learned in my lifetime leads back to this. The fires and the black river of loss, whose other side is salvation, whose meaning none of us will ever know. To live in this world, you must be able to do three things. To love what is mortal, to hold it against your bones, knowing your own life depends upon it, and when the time comes, to let it go, to let it go. Thank you. Are we supposed to be done now? Huh? I don't have any idea. I probably talked too long.
We have time for questions.
Okay.
I just wanted to share an experience I had. So I like to travel. I like to do a foreign trip once a year. And I want to share like two experiences I had. One time I was in Thailand in 2023 and I had a guide, and they did an amazing tour of, we went on a boat and we saw these caverns and these like monkeys living their whole life in the caverns. And on the way back, they were like throwing out little pieces of meat, and we had this fleet of eagles chasing after us. And this is just a phenomenal experience. It was like $125. I handed my guide 500 baht, which is about $15. And the dance he did of gratitude, I was like, I was like, it's just $15. And I was like, just astounded, like, you know. And this past trip I did in April, I went to Bali. And I was walking along the street in Ubud. I was just walking to my hotel room, and there was this little five-year-old following me. And, you know, trying to sell like a fan or something. And I don't know if I should be ashamed, but I was like, hey, when you're of age, college is free in Germany. Like, I said that several times, and then I handed him 100,000 rupiah, which is like $6. And the amount of, I don't know what would have made the difference. I'm like hoping like maybe in 15 years he's like, oh, I can go to Germany and get a free education. But I wonder if like just $7 made a difference. It's like we have suffering here, but like $15, the dance of gratitude I have from a 25-year-old guide was like.
Do you know what's the most interesting thing about what you're saying to me, anyway? We actually don't know what effect we're going to have in the world.
Yeah.
So we just try to do the right thing at the moment, whatever feels like the right thing. And you don't know. I mean, maybe that young boy ends up getting an education in Germany. Or maybe he finds a way to succeed where he is.
Yeah.
One way or the other,
I'm thinking
he knew you cared.
And I'm thinking, even like when I got to Bali, I changed out $500 and I got 7 million rupiah, and it was like this thick, and I'm like, I was like, what the? I'm like, what is the exchange here?
Did you feel rich?
I was like, I'm like, what is the difference between my existence here and like,
yes,
versus like 100, what is 100, like 100 rupiah, that's the biggest denomination, it's like $6.
Mm-hmm. So you need a big stack.
And so I'm like when you hear foreign travelers who were like, don't get taken by the tuk-tuks in Bangkok, because mm-hmm. They're ripping you off. And I'm like, but I mean, $15, I mean, like how much gratitude they have by giving like a few more dollars. It's like, what is it costing you?
Mm-hmm. So always be generous when you can.
I think so. It's not, I mean, the difference to you is like, it's so much different to them when it's costing you so little.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. Is there anyone online who would like to say something?
Sure.
Go ahead.
Tremendous talk. Best wishes to you on your journey. It sounds really difficult to me, but it sounds like you're prepared and you're excited. And thank you so much for your generosity tonight. That was the most generous gift I have received in years.
Oh.
Thank you.
Oh, well, thank you. And please take it to heart that our relationship goes on forever. That's the incredible thing to me. And yeah, you would think that some of the stuff that's happening for me is difficult, but actually, I'm here to say that this is what a life of practice does. It makes it possible for us to face those difficult mm-hmm. things, because we're all going to be doing it. We're all going to be facing the death of loved ones. It's like Thich Nhat Hanh says at the end, everything's going to be taken away from you, and the only thing that's left to you are your actions, the consequences of your actions. Mm-hmm. And your actions are the ground upon which you stand. So to be generous, to be kind, to be compassionate, whenever possible. This is, I think I've said this before, but at the end of his life, Aldous Huxley, who was this incredibly famous philosopher and writer, published many books, you know, very well known. And when he was asked at the end of his life, you know, what's your takeaway here? What's, you know, the important thing you learned? And he said, well, it might sound a little odd, but it'd be awfully nice if people could just be a little kinder to each other. I thought, there's a Buddhist for you. Anyway, thank you so much. Anybody else? Share some bucket of water you've given to someone recently.
Well, early in your talk, when you were talking about Dizhang and the futility of trying to capture Buddhism in a stream of words and intellectual pursuits, and you asked, had any of us ever struggled with trying to explain to a non-Buddhist friend what the world we do here? And it reminded me of something that happened to me when I first started practice. And an old dear friend of mine, who has perhaps a sort of prickly sense of humor, said, well, Dave, Buddhist meditation, eh? How is that different from just falling asleep? And I knew this guy pretty well, and I knew he was just being annoying and so forth. And normally in a situation like that, I would think of exactly the right thing to say after 2 or 3 hours. But for some reason, the turning word actually struck me at this particular junction. And I said, "Michael, that's a very good question that you ask there, but I would just phrase it a little differently. I wouldn't say, how is meditation different from falling asleep? I'd say, how is meditation like waking up?"
Oh, excellent.
Doesn't happen very often, but the turning word came that time.
Isn't it wonderful? I mean, when it happens, it's just like, oh, I got it. I'll have to remember that day. Thank you. Anybody else in there in Zoom land want to speak up? It's nice to see people. All my old friends, there are people here who used to sit at Kanando. Earl and Vanya and Howard. Keegan's online. Diane's online. Irene, I haven't seen you in a long time. It's awfully nice to see you.
I was trying to unmute Misha.
You're unmuted now, Diane. Go for it.
I know. I'm finally unmuted. I'm thinking back to when we first met on College Avenue and how welcoming you were to me and made me feel so at home and immediately included me in the service and learning how to do the bells and clean the bathroom and do the work period and participate in the sesshins. And it just felt so comforting and welcoming. And I wanted to express my gratitude to you for that.
Diane, yes. If it weren't for you, you are one of the backbone people here. So well, it's I who expressing gratitude to you for carrying Kanando forward.
Well, I just show up, Misha. I just show up.
That's all we, you know, that's all we need to do. We need to show up.
Right.
Completely. So thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
I have a question.
Okay.
Yeah, this is Chris here. Thank you very much for the teaching. I read it somewhere. I think it's very interesting in terms of difficulties. They said in the meditation, if it's one part, then in the moving meditation, it will be 10 parts more difficult. If one part in the moving meditation, that will be 10 parts harder than in dreams. And one part in dreams will be 10 times in sickness. And one part in sickness will be 10 times harder when you leave this world, right? So this is a degree of difficulties as you're going down. I think it's very, very difficult to fighting with the ego. I think at the end, when everything is talked about the ego, right? The remembrance of the separation of the I of mine and me and so on and so forth. I think that's the most difficult thing to get rid of, you know, even at the most difficult time. Like I say, you have to leave, right? So get rid of everything probably is okay, but getting rid of your own ego is super difficult. So now my question is, how do you like practice that kind of letting go on very kind of on daily basis, right? To let it go, like just like give more tips to other people, for example, that I just talked before, like give your love to things to somebody else that they really want it. How do you kind of practice that kind of thing to cultivate this letting go of your own ego so you get better prepared, you know?
Good question, Christopher. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, getting out of our own wake turns out to be the hardest thing of all. They say that at the end of life, the last thing to leave us is our restlessness. And I think it's the restlessness of being concerned about what's going to happen to me after I die, which is just more ego, right? So my best, the only thing I have ever found that helps me with this, because we all suffer from this, is turning my attention outward, turning my attention to being there for other people and helping in any way I can and setting myself aside whenever I can. because a lot of the times we're the center of our own movie, right? And what we have to realize is everybody's got a movie going, and to step out of the movie altogether. So the best advice I can give is be paying attention to everybody else, and you'll find that you get what you need. I mean, this is the thing. The ego gets strong because it's afraid it's not going to get what it needs. And actually, when we turn our attention outward to everyone else, we get exactly what we need.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's a good tip. Thank you very much.
So I think we probably...
It's 9:05.
Yep, we need to end.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.